Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, together with my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Matt is a nationally recognized expert spokesperson on mental health and substance use disorder issues. He utilizes his experience and expertise to lead the Betty Ford Center's outpatient services as its director.
If you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, the show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addiction, and so much more.
Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, our topic today is the Alzheimer, or keep your friends close and, I forgot the other thing, which is the exact title of Joseph DePrisco's new book.
Joe's work has appeared in numerous newspapers, magazines, and literary journals, and his poetry has received several prizes. Among his many books includes Subway to California and Sun City. Joe has also co-authored two highly regarded books about child and family development.
Now, we're told that once he overheard his son being asked by his cousin if he was worried that his dad was publishing a memoir. His son said, "Worried? I don't know, but there seems to be two kinds of memoirs. One that's about things like landing a plane in the Hudson, and the other is about things like hookers and blow in Vegas. And as far as I know, my dad's never landed a plane in the Hudson."
Joe attended an all-boys Catholic high school, Syracuse University, and the University of California at Berkeley, where he completed his graduate studies. For 20 years, Joe's taught middle school, high school, and college. He has sat on and consulted with several nonprofit boards in the areas of education, mental health, child's welfare, and the arts. And he is Chair Emeritus of Redwood Day School in Oakland, California.
Joe, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Alan, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Matt and I both had a chance to be able to read the book. Now, for me, I read it usually at the gym. And this time, as I had the book open, and one of the regulars there came up to me and said, "What's it about?" And so I started explaining a little bit, and they actually came up with probably, I think, the biggest question that a lot of people ask. And it said, so how much of the novel is based on your own experiences of taking care of your father, you know, versus kind of talking about this life of the mob?
Well, that's a great question, and it's something that I get asked all the time, because in a way, fiction is a way to tell the truth, even as you're lying, making up stuff. And it's one thing to write a memoir where your objective is to tell the truth and the unpleasant truth as well as the pleasant truth. But with fiction, in this case, writing a story about a mobster who is confronting both his rivals who are out to take him, out to get rid of him, and is encroaching dementia, I found myself remembering, thinking back on dealing with my father and mother, for that matter, who were dealing with their own dementia. And, you know, being with you, Answers for the Family, it just underscores how much dementia, Alzheimer's, is a family issue. Yes, it's a universal problem for all of us. If somebody isn't aware of somebody they care about who has dementia, they will. And I know very few people who aren't terrified over the prospect of dementia and losing control of one's memory and one's function, mental function. So for me, dealing with my dad The wrinkle was, I mean, I get asked, so is this a novel about a mobster who has dementia or about dementia which happens to afflict the mobster? Well, yeah. it's both, I guess. And I'm also asked, well, is this a tragic story or is this a comic story? And I say, yes, it is. Because, and when we're really in the throes, when we're focusing on somebody who is ravaged by a disease, an insidious, overwhelming disease like Alzheimer's, we find ourselves being tested continually. We find ourselves being humbled before the prospect of what somebody's going through. So if you ever look at, for instance, a functional electronic magnetic resonance imaging of a brain of someone afflicted with Alzheimer's, which you get in the autopsy, you can see there are lots of gaps. Mm. And so people, they can't connect. Things don't really connect the way they used to, but something is going on, and the person is still there. The person you love is still there. The person you care about, the person you have to take care of is still there. So you're continually trying to understand what is the surreality of it. It's an Alice in Wonderland upside down kind of world, and you find yourself in the middle of incredibly complicated conversations, or silences for that matter. So I don't, that's a long way around answering your question. I don't know if I got to it.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, there's a lot of nonfiction in there with the Alzheimer's, and also you know, growing up, it sounds like your dad actually was in the mob growing up. So what was, you know, when and how did you find out about that, and what was that like growing up?
Well, we grew up in Brooklyn, and in the 50s and 60s, my dad was a small-time hustler and con man and compulsive gambler and bookmaker, and a lot of the stuff I really didn't understand. I knew what was going on one day when we were walking down a road in Long Island and at my grandparents' farm, and what city kid doesn't like a farm? You got donkeys, you got pigs, you got rabbits, you got watermelon, you got tomatoes, you got all that stuff you don't get in Greenpoint. So, and walking down the road, and he says, go back to Grandma's house, and he runs off into the woods. And surrounding my grandparents' house, all these police cars, the FBI, the New York State police were after him because he was working with dirty cops who were shaking down gamblers and parole violators, and he was, you know, dealing with pretty disreputable. This is pre-Knapp Commission, pre-Serpico, but right on the cusp there. So yeah, who was involved in all that stuff? I didn't really know about it until I knew some. I had an inkling. When I would ask him about stuff, especially as he began to descend, I'd say, why are you asking me all these questions? And I said, well, I'm just trying to remember. And he says, well, I'm trying to forget. I said, okay. I respect that. But I came across about a year and a half ago, I came across these New York State Appellate Division trials, some I never knew existed. And there I find my father is the star witness in a series of trials involving these corrupt cops. And he's the star. He's the one who knows everything, and he sort of turns states. He's extradited from California. Oh yeah, we take off to California. We run to California, and I don't want to be in California. I'm a Brooklyn kid.
Mm-hmm.
No offense, but so there. You know, but I've lived in California. I feel like a tourist for 50 years, but I still can't make my peace with the Dodgers coming to Los Angeles. I still have my Brooklyn Dodgers gear. Anyway. So we're in California, and he gets extradited, and there's a memorable moment in one of these transcripts, which are fascinating to me anyway. One of the attorneys for the cops is badgering him about an inconsistency in his previous testimony, and he says, oh, so do you remember saying that in the past? And my old man says, yes, I do, and the lawyer says, well, when you said that, was that true? And the old man says, it was true at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my old man. That's Brooklyn. And that's what I had to deal with Now, it gets more complicated as he descended into dementia, because in a weird way, I found out more. I know Matt's pretty aware of all this kind of stuff, and you are too, Alan, about, I mean, the brain, my God, we know so little about it. We know these billions of neurons are doing something or making connections. Especially long-term memory is still can function pretty well. It's the short-term memory that's totally ravaged. So I would find out stuff that I didn't really know before, but it all didn't click until these transcripts came to my attention, and then I began to understand. Well, you know, he is a criminal. You know, not a very successful one, but that was his life. And so for me growing up, school was never a big deal. My parents never got out of the eighth grade. I'm the only one in my family to graduate from high school. So I was the black sheep in the family by someone who liked going to school. This was very strange in my mm-hmm. family. But that's where that and in the church, the Catholic Church, that's where I found meaning both. And then I began to write when I was a little kid. I remember giving my father a copy of my first book of poems a long time ago, and I didn't like it. Why didn't you like it, Dad? Won't pay the light bill. I said, okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. How did he know that? Who tipped him off? That's my question.
Right.
The old man
right.
is continually surprising to me, which is, I think, one of the lessons here of dealing with someone with Alzheimer's is that unless you need to listen, it's sort of related to what happens when we're as a parent, when we're working with we're parenting our adolescent children. If you're listen, you have to listen. You have to pay attention to what's not being said, to what's being said, and you need to be open to the wonder and the strangeness of that developmental stage. And I think something similar is going on with dementia, where we just don't know. And you need to accept the terms of their reality. So, for instance, he would say, like, have you seen my wife lately? Which is how he would refer to my mother. Have you seen my wife lately? And I would stupidly say, you know, Dad, you know, she's gone. She's been gone for a while. Which is exactly the wrong thing to say. You need to accept the terms of their experience, their aspirations, their neediness. And that's the key, I think, to your own sanity when you're dealing with it with someone with Alzheimer's, which goes to the point I started to make a second ago, which was that it's a family issue, and you find yourself, you know, everyone is affected by it in a different way because it's so humbling, because it levels you to deal with, to see someone decompensating right in front of you. You
mm-hmm.
just, I know.
Now, Joe, you mentioned about questions, you know, like, have you seen my wife lately? You know, your dad saying something like that and saying what the wrong answer is. You know, for anybody out there that's listening, what is the right answer, or is there one?
I don't know that there is exactly a right answer, but I know that if they could, if my dad could have made that connection, he wouldn't need me to tell him that was the connection to make. And I think to sit with someone with that, and, you know, yeah, Mom was, you know, I don't think lying is ever called for here, but it is important to acknowledge, you know, yeah, Mom was a great cook, or Mom was funny, or Mom had a terrible temper, or Mom swore like a trucker. Everybody knew that. And to sort of give him a sense of, yeah, his feelings, respect the feelings that he has. Now, he's missing his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He's missing what he had, which is in a weird way because they fought nonstop my entire life. And FCC regulations would not permit me to say the kinds of things my mother would say to him. But believe me, she knew how to phrase her language pretty colorfully, and vice versa. So they had a very combative, violent relationship. It was straight out of off on the waterfront, actually.
Mm.
So the right answer is, it's an approach, I think. It's to be there with somebody, and that is what's so taxing. and so painful for everybody. And no, I don't want to call attention to my own feelings about this, except to say that when you're the best way to be with someone is to be with the person. Yeah, that person is now limited. Yeah, that person has now been deconstructed in some way. But it's still somebody. It's still your father.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, one of the things I really appreciated was, you know, you've got these truly heartbreaking events, but you were able to find humor in a lot of it, and you were able to look at it in a way where, you know, you while I'm reading it, you're chuckling, and it's you were able to find a lighter side to a lot of it. What does that spring out of?
Well, I quote Joan Rivers here, the great Joan Rivers. If you laugh at something, you shrink the dragon. And I think of the books that have meant the most to me growing up, and as I began to write, I'm not comparing my book to anybody else's, something like Catch-22 or anything by Vonnegut or Beckett, or even a movie like Life is Beautiful, the Roberto Benigni movie, which is, you know, is horrible circumstances, Holocaust, World War II, and these are, and there are moments of hilarity. Why is that true? This is one of the mysteries, I think, of
right.
human existence. You know, this desire, when we see something that is so incongruous, we laugh to keep from crying, or vice versa. So yeah, the old man was, you know, hilarious, but mostly in ways that I don't even know he appreciated. And so to be in that, so this character, Mikey, who's going through his own drama, which might be called some stages of mild cognitive impairment, or even maybe more appropriate, subjective cognitive impairment, where you get the sense, you know, when one is descending into them, you sort of know things are not, your brain is making connect, you know that I'm not really firing on all cylinders, but I'm firing on enough cylinders to know that I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like landing, you know, your brain is like a fish, a line caught fish that's, you know, on the boat deck, and there it is, sort of, and you can't really control it. So the humor seems to me, I certainly don't make fun of dementia or Alzheimer's, that's the farthest thing from my mind, but there are moments of hilarity that what happens to Mikey is that he's surrounded by his crew who, you know, who can't really shoot straight or speak straight, and they're struggling with him, and they think, well, this guy's, he's a goner, and they're trying to set him up now because they think he's weak, and they make a major miscalculation in that regard.
Yep. And I think that's one of the nice, you know, the nice twists kind of in the book is that, you know, it's not always what you think and such. But, you know, as you were talking about again with your father, how old were you when you started to assume that role of caretaker for your father? And at that point, did he still have any connection, you know, to organized crime, or was that pretty much after he had testified and, you know, and was not accepted?
Well, these are big questions, and I think he always had associations that he cultivated over the years. When he came to California, he got a job as a truck driver, and he eventually became a Teamster president, which is perfect, and you know, running a milk driver's local. And he got investigated by the FBI for kickbacks, and he was clear to that, although I didn't know any, this is the old man, the secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very Italian thing, it's a very Brooklyn thing. And he would, I knew nothing about this until I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request about him. And I get all this material about a federal investigation into him. Did he ever tell me about it? No.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the strange little coincidences, if not ironies here, is, you know, I was the subject of a racketeering investigation when I was in my 20s. It's a long story I tell in Subway to California.
Right, but was that just through association, or how did that come about?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, everybody knew people with a lot of vowels in their names. You know, we all hung around with the same people. You know, I played cards for a living with the fellows who ran the Italian restaurants, and there was a lot of bookmaking going on and a lot of gambling. And that was the world we were in. While I was doing that, I was also writing my dissertation at Berkeley. How I put that together, I can't really explain. That's why I wrote the memoir, Subway to California. That's why you quote my son at the beginning, because he gets mystified every now and then. I got a lot of, you surprised me a lot, Dad. Okay, great. Now forget you ever read that. So my grandsons want to read it. No, you can't read the book.
How old's the grandson?
We got 10 and an 8 and a 6. So
when do you think is the age that it would be time that it would be okay to read it?
Well, the 10-year-old wants to read it now. He's the bookish one. He's the one who's always badgering me. And he did try to read one of them one time, and unfortunately, he didn't. Unbeknownst to me, and then he read it for about an hour and a novel. And I don't know what the. I think there comes a point when you know with your kids, can they? Are the mysteries? Are they just mysteries, or are there? Are there things that they're not prepared to deal with? So when I tell this to the 10-year-old, the 10-year-old says, yeah, but no, I read about stuff I don't understand all the time. I said, okay.
It's called school.
Yes, he's going to give us a lot of trouble. I can see that.
Something tells me.
But you know what they say about grandparents and grandchildren? They're united by a common enemy.
Something tells me your bedtime stories are probably the most interesting on the block. But
yeah,
and speaking of, you know, children, I know that you've written a lot of essays, fictions, and even some of your nonfiction stuff on child family development. Tell us about that book that you wrote on child and family development, and did that come from your dad or your son?
Well, I think in some weird and perhaps perverse or some complicated way, I was trying to work with my own failures as a parent. I worked a lot with teenagers and taught a lot. And my best experiences teaching took place in high school. And now these teenagers are mine. Now they're my doctors. So they I don't know how that happened, but now they're people who. So, what's the one book that we wrote was A Field Guide to the American Teenager, and the lesson there, of course, is that if you're not surprised by your kids, you're just not paying attention, and teenagers will test you, and they will make you confront your fears about yourself and about them. So to stay with your teenagers, whether they're students or your own children, in my case, you need to be able to be very honest. You need to be in integrity with yourself. Now that doesn't mean telling everything you did. It's not that interesting. Finally, for a teenager to hear about all those wild times you had, you think that's interesting? It's not, or the mild times for that matter, because mainly for every teenager. They're the exception to every rule. Their experience is unique. Mm-hmm. And what you have to tell them is not, you know, okay, you did that, but, you know. So I know parents are, that's a big conundrum for a lot of parents. Do I tell the truth about, you know, smoking dope? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you can do it once or twice in your lifetime with your kids. But finally, you have to be the parent there, and you need to be able to give them the foundation to confront their own challenges, and because what you do with them as they're growing up, I mean, these kind of tapes are they're going to run at the moment of truth, you know, and that will help, believe it or not. Well, you know that.
Yeah. Well, and when you mention the fact that they're really not that interested or whatever, or our stories aren't that interesting, I think you and I may be the exception to that rule,
okay.
You know, but I think the advice then for most of the people out there is that, you know, your stories probably aren't, you know, the things that the teenagers are dying to find out about. So yes, I definitely understand that. You know, we're going to take a break, but for everybody out there, if you want to follow along with us, you can go to Joe's website. It's www.diprisco.com/the Allshammer, and that is spelt THE-ALZHAMMER. If you want to go to the site, you can follow along with us, but stay with us because we will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and our topic today is the new book, The Allshammer, or Keep Your Friends Close, and I forgot the other thing, which I thought was a great title.
Well, yes. Thank you. Yes, it's an obvious reference to The Godfather, which is a constant theme. I have a friend who's in the New York State judiciary, and he and I can have whole conversations using nothing but dialogue from The Godfather. Leave the gun, take the cannoli, you know, make him an offer he can't refuse. In Sicily, women are more dangerous than shotguns. Never cross the family. You know, you can use these things everywhere. So yeah, so keep your friends close and your enemies closer is what Don Corleone says in The Godfather, and that's one of the great movies of all time.
Yeah, and I loved in one of the reviews, I thought it was great because so many people, you know, when you're reading the book, they'll ask, well, what's it like? You know, give me something. And one of the best lines I loved, and I think it was by Anne Hellerman, that said, well, just think Cuckoo's Nest meets The Godfather. Hilarious.
Yeah, that was nice of her to say that. That was great. Yeah.
And getting in a little more to detail into the book, what are three things that you tell people who are beginning to deal with, like, a loved one who has dementia or Alzheimer's?
Well, I would say take care of yourself. One thing I would say is take care of yourself. I had a wonderful care manager who dealt with my dad and my mom, for that matter. And who was brilliant and a psychiatrist, and she was able to help me a lot. I mean, I felt like I was getting therapy from her, and that was very important to me to get that kind of support. And that's why I would say get help. That's the crucial thing. And I'd also say take care of yourself. You know, when someone is really falling apart and you can't. The old markers just aren't there. You need to be able to, do something good for yourself. And I know that sounds sort of trivial, but it's not. And then remember, finally, that this is a family issue. Everybody is involved in this. I remember the last argument I had with my son. Was not a pleasant moment. He was very upset with me when I took away my father's driver's license and his credit cards. And he said, well, you're disrespecting him. This is wrong. You're not, you know, you know, what harm could happen? So he runs up his credit card. What's the big deal? And it was a very heated exchange, and we finally got around to understanding what was at the source of this. Is, you know, he loved his grandfather, and he was concerned about him, but he didn't really understand the risk, for instance, of somebody wandering off.
Mm-hmm.
And how vulnerable these people are, and how they're not yet. You remember who they were. They're not that person anymore.
Yeah, right.
They don't have that power anymore. They don't. And at the same time, my father was. You know, after I took away his credit cards, and somehow he went to the bank. I don't know how he got there even, and talked them into giving him some money from his bank account. He had no ID or nothing. He was incredibly resourceful. He would. My care manager, Dr. Rosenthal, tells a story. I've never met anybody who had so much cash. He would run around at the assisted living place, and he'd try to tip people out, which is... And I said, well, I think he's trying to organize the laborers. Said, yeah, that's exactly what they're worried about.
Crafty. It fascinates me, you know, you grew up with him as this... you know, powerful figure, and then you become, you know, a caretaker. And when I'm working, you know, as a therapist, a lot of times I see people's roles change, and it's difficult for people to change in their role from, you know, child to caretaker and now father. For you, was you know, kind of switching into this role of caretaker difficult, or, you know, what was that like for you?
Well, it was immensely challenging because, as I've been saying, you know, my father was a very mysterious fellow, by which I mean he was a great liar, and so was my mother, and they were perfect for each other in that regard. I mean, the truth was just a totally, you know, irrelevant proposition. They just wanted you to do what they wanted you to do. So for me, for instance, when I was a kid, I was one of those kids who, you know, had a million questions, you know, about baseball and birds and bees and Jesus and one question after the other. And my father's continual retort to me is, what are you writing a book?
And, and as it turns out.
Okay, I guess you're right. I guess I was reading a book. So the irony, yes, it was very challenging, especially because, you know, here I am trying to figure him out as I'm a kid or as an adult when the narcissism paled long enough for me to be concerned about somebody else besides myself. I would find myself thinking, gee, this is somebody I'm beginning to understand, but this is, he can't tell the story anymore. He can't give me all the information that I need. So those transcripts were very crucial for me. Mm-hmm. So it ended up, yeah, what are you writing a book? Well, yeah, it turns out that he couldn't write the book about himself, but I had to write the book about himself. And the moment was when I was trying to realize who he was, he couldn't see me at all. He was gone. I was gone for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extremely challenging, and my wife would tell you that, who was great with him, and they had a good relationship. Say that the cost was very high, very mm-hmm. high. And once again, it's a whole family issue. My younger brother died from a drug overdose, and one of the most poignant moments was very late on. I was in his assisted living residence, and my brother John, you were asking me what age this all started mm-hmm. happening, and this is in my 50s. And my father says to me one day, out of the blue, is John coming by? It just completely leveled me. Because the last mm-hmm. time we'd seen him, yeah, he was about to be buried. So these are the kinds of painful memories that, I never shake. And probably they're at the root of this story, the Alzheimer.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, when we were doing our research, you know, we were looking at some of the other works that you've done, and one of the things that jumped out was your novels seem to be either about organized crime or the Catholic Church. So what connects these subjects for you?
Isn't it obvious? Organized crime, organized religion, disorganized crime, disorganized religion. Yeah, I think I'm fascinated by, well, they're both family systems, really.
Yeah.
The mob is a family system. The church is a family system. It's hard to imagine an institution that failed more miserably than the Catholic Church during this whole pedophile crisis. It continues to be the challenge for the Catholic Church. So, yeah, this is, and yet, you know, I grew up a Catholic. It was like I lived in a monastery when I was a young man. I was Brother Joseph for a while. Great experience. Learned how to drink wine.
Mm-hmm.
Learned how to pick grapes. And it's more humility, right? It's about being a monk. Finally, that didn't work for me. So what I like to think about is when I try to understand how I got interested in both crime and in the church is they both appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
They both riveted my attention. I think it's that it's this feeling that this totalizing kind of understanding of life, there it is. You have to give over to these institutions because they're just people. And their families.
Now, what was your father's reaction when you were Father Joe?
When I was Brother Joe,
Brother Joe, right.
Yeah, no, he was, mystified. But he was mystified by everything, you know, not the poetry, not including the poetry book, but, I mean, it's about, you know, school, and I don't know, would he have been proud? His reaction was, well, I don't know, I mean, one time, we were going on some retreat, and he came up to the monastery. He was visiting there or something. He knew we were going away to Russian River or something. And he brought me a bottle of Jack Daniels, which came in handy.
Yeah, in case you get tired of the wine.
Yeah. So, you know, what was his reaction? I think he didn't understand what I was up to. That's pretty clear. I think he was troubled, for instance, when the moment came, when he began to become conscious that I was managing his affairs. He was essentially unmanageable,
mm-hmm.
but I was, you know, I had the bank accounts, I had to pay his bills because he was triple paying, you know, I had to do all that. And he just threw up his hands one day and he says, I guess you're kind of an honest guy. That's okay.
Throw you a bone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I don't, and it's one of the mysteries of my life I'm still struggling with.
Well, we're very thankful for having our listener questions, and one came in that says, I was in an airport recently and witnessed an elderly woman's son speaking cruelly to her. She was repeatedly asking the same question every few minutes about when they were going to board the plane. Regardless of how much information is out there about this condition, I feel very few people are emotionally prepared to deal with it. Can you describe what it was like for you, and do you feel your novel will give insight and help to those who are caring for their elders with Alzheimer's or dementia?
Well, yeah, and that's a common kind of occurrence, of course, because the short-term memory is so shot, they don't really remember anything that's been happening recently, so they have to keep asking the question. This keeps them in the moment in some weird Zen way. I mean, there's been research lately about, these Alzheimer's support groups where Alzheimer's patients are gathering together to talk to each other. And what's interesting is that in this moment, some people are making the claim, well, this is actually a time of some kind of joy. And I think that's way overstated. But there's something to it that when people are in the moment like that and they can't escape the moment and they're in this bubble, how can we deal with that? Well, I go back to what I keep saying. It's about being humbled before it and to accept the mystery of what's going on. So to take a huge step back here to answer the question about how the book might help somebody or not, I mean, what's fiction about? It's about making the familiar strange and the strange familiar. And when one is immersed in this imaginative world of a fiction, it's sort of related to what's going on in the Alice in Wonderland world of an Alzheimer's patient. We have to be able to remember continually that they're not trying to be difficult. Mm-hmm. That's all they can do. That's all they can do. And it stretches us out so much. I mean, and it was very frustrating, I'll admit that, to deal with that on an ongoing basis. You know, take them out to lunch, and 20 minutes later I get a call, what are you doing for lunch? You know, okay, it's sad, but yeah, you have to accept it. It doesn't help them to say, we just had lunch. He doesn't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
So for my guys in this novel here, my protagonist, Mikey, the mob boss who's losing it, he's continually trying to compensate for what goes on. He's in that state of subjective cognitive impairment most of the time, where he's sort of conscious of what's going on, but can't really make the connections that he needs to make all the time. So for him, he does pull it off. He does do something that people wouldn't have expected him to do. And so if we're with the people we care about, who are suffering from Alzheimer's, we can celebrate the moments of pleasure, victory. I remember bringing the grandkids over to see my father, and how much, you know, joy he had in that. You know, and they were great, because they would, you know, they weren't little monks, because they could say, they could get one ice cream, and then 10 minutes later, they can get another ice cream. And they played it.
Of course. Well, you know, I was going to say, I was on a plane, or I was reading a book about a gentleman that was on a plane, and it was the most beautiful kind of statement or scene that he talks about, which is, he said that he was seated next to a young man whose mother, I believe it was whose mother, you know, was right at that point, you know, going through Alzheimer's, and he had a picture book, you know, he had this, you know, album, and he said, and the gentleman telling the story is saying that, like, every 10 minutes or so, you know, she would ask something, and he would bring out the picture book from under the seat, and they would go over it again. And he said throughout that flight, which was, like, he said he was flying like 8 hours or something like that, he must have done it, you know, 40 times, but he would pull it out, he would open it up, and he would go through, and the pictures sort of took her through her life, you know, and brought it right up to date. And he said that what he loved most about it was that as she was doing it, she was smiling. She was smiling as she's going through it, and he said that there wasn't a lot of dialogue. In other words, the son, or you know, whoever that's sitting with her, didn't go into a lot of dialogue or anything else. Just took the pictures through and answered questions very briefly, and just let her take it in, however her brain was taking it in. And I thought that was really interesting, because I wouldn't have normally thought of that.
Well, that's a beautiful example of what happens when you're working with somebody who is a care manager, who knows, not really to say tricks, but those kinds of things that help people. Even little notes around the house about anything, reminders of what's going on. Mikey does this in Alzheimer's too, or tries to, but he forgets that. Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful to bring people back. That's a wonderful image about the picture book. That's so good. That's a great idea. And my father thrilled to that kind of stuff. He liked seeing those pictures all the time, especially of his wife. It would make him happy.
Now, are you having situation? I mean, did you bring video into it? Because again, the story that I was telling was someone who was talking about something that I think was still many years ago. Now, would that be something that, you know, with, you know, iPhones and everything else, that you might have a video that you can play for them, or is that maybe involving too much audio?
That is very hard, I think, for, and Matt might have an opinion about this too. I think that's very hard. I mean, at some point, I think this is true, that someone with Alzheimer's has a very hard time with video. It's very hard to see stuff unfolding. It's happening too fast. The brain is firing all over the place and can't make the connections. We didn't use any video. We used still photos, and that my wife's a photographer, so she had lots of photos, and he was able, but he would have he'd have elaborate sort of myths about his own life and people he would mention as if we knew them. And I didn't know half these people, but he would talk about people that I was supposed to know, but I didn't. Somebody named Pete I didn't know anything about, but Pete became important, and he would have dialogues, you know, is the boat here, you know, okay, is the gate closed, we're winning more than we're losing, and he would, it became sort of symphonic and poetic and tragic.
And you would focus on being in the moment with him and...
Yeah, you try. Yeah, I can certainly remember all my failures. It's very hard to do this, and I'm certainly not nominating myself for canonization. It was, had my own failures. You try to do the best you can and try to take care of them.
Well, what fascinates me too about your life story is throughout all these, you know, different life events, both positive and negative, it seems to me that writing was the outlet for you.
Yes. I remember reading when I was a young guy, high school, I guess, you know, don't become a writer unless you can't imagine not being a writer. And I said, okay, that's me. I wasn't intimidated by that. Now, it's about, because really when you're trying to fashion a world, in fiction or nonfiction for that matter, I mean, that's where you put meaning together. And, my parents didn't hand over, and this is not, I'm not blaming my parents for their lives. They've suffered enough on their own terms. And they gave me plenty. And they took away plenty, too. But the when you're making your own world, you make your own meaning. That was the gift, I think. I mean, it's a cliche, you know, that, and it's because it's true, that the greatest gift for a writer is a miserable childhood. It's true.
Yeah. I've heard it. We have another listener question coming in, and again, we thank those that take the time to either email these in or instant message them, and we also recognize that sometimes that's better than calling because we're not the greatest at working the board here. So this one reads, my grandfather was a doctor in Chicago for what he called, quote, the outfit. And it says, you know, although we perceived him as a bit gruff in his younger years, I remember how kind he became after his dementia set in. I guess we were the lucky ones, as this may rarely be the outcome. I can't wait to read your book and share it with my siblings and cousins, as I'm sure your characters will bring back memories for all of us.
Well, I hope so. That's a great thing. A person said, moods. Somebody with my dad's case with Alzheimer's. Yeah, his moods softened a little bit over time. He's a tough guy. He was a take no bull, you know, kind of guy, gruff, kind of violent. But he became, and I attribute this a lot to his relationship with my own son, who he loved very much and was loved in return by my son. I think that helped him a lot. Of course, he thought he was baby Jesus, my son. Walked on water. He's the grandson, right? Mm-hmm. So those moods did soften a little bit over time. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
And for all those listeners, Joe, what's the best way for us to go out and get the book?
Well, everywhere. My website, deprisco.com, has lots of links, and there are, if you do any kind of online search, you'll see 1,000 sort of links. So it's everywhere out there.
We really wanted to thank Joe DePrisco for being here. Again, the book, The Allshammer, please go out and read it. Also, all guests, tune in next week when our guest will be Logan Clark and my co-host here, Alan Cardoza, to discuss a very disturbing and emotional traumatic issue that unfortunately is far too familiar with the families that we deal with, parental kidnapping. If you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or check us out and subscribe to the show on iTunes. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please spread the word. Also, please provide your mailing address. Alan would love to send you a personal thank you note after the show. And of course, your address will not be used for any other purposes.
All right, Joe, thank you again so much for coming on. We appreciate it. As soon as you write the next one, let us know. We would love to have you back. And also, let us know if this gets picked up for a movie, because after reading it, I could sure see where somebody out there is going to go, this should be on the screen.
Hold that thought. Well, it's been fun talking to you guys. It was a great experience. Thanks so much, and thanks for all you're doing for the family.
You got it. Take care, everybody.
Right,
and everybody, be good humans. Be with us next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.